Chapter 22. He slid down the last of the trail, and he asked of me, "Do you see what you expected?" And this was a question breaking loose, rolling free, out from under stones and scattered into thoughts of what the cruel fates would now decree. He settled back in the dust and made his face into pain. "Did you see only what you believed?" And I looked down to where blood had left its stain, a charge of what's given, what's received, announcing the closing dirge on this long campaign. "No," I said, "you are not what I expected to see. Young as hope and true as love was my enemy. The shields were burnished bright as a sun-splashed sea, and drowning courage hath brought me to this calamity. Expectation has so proved the death of me." He spoke to say, "You cannot war against the man you were, and I cannot slay the man I shall one day become. Our enemy is expectation flung backward and fore, the memories you choose and the tracks I would run, slayer of dreams, sower of regrets, all that we are." Soldier at the end of his days, fragment, Desban of Nemil. They did not stop for the night. With the city's fitful glow to the north, throbbing crimson, Traveller marched as would a man possessed. At times, as she and Kasa rode on ahead to the next rise to fix their gazes upon that distant conflagration, Samardev feared that he might, upon reaching them, simply lash out with his sword, cut them both down, so that he could take havoc for himself and ride hard for Darujistan. Something terrible was happening in that city. Her nerves were on fire. Her skull seemed to creak with some kind of pervasive pressure, building with each onward step. She felt febrile, sick to her stomach, her mouth dry as dust, and she held on to Kasa Orlong's muscled girth as if he was a mast on a storm-racked ship. He had said nothing for some time now, and she did not have the courage to break that grim silence. Less than a league away, the city flashed and rumbled. When Traveller reached them, however, it was as if they did not exist. He was muttering under his breath, vague arguments, hissed denials, breathless lists of bizarre, disconnected phrases, each one worked out as if it was a justification for something he had done, or something he was about to do. At times those painful phrases sounded like justifications for both. Future blended with the past, a swirling vortex with a tortured soul at its very heart. She could not bear to listen. Obsession was a madness, a fever. When it clawed its way to the surface, it was terrible to behold. It was impossible not to see the damage it did, the narrowness of the treacherous path one was forced to walk, as if between walls of thorns, jutting knife blades. One misstep and blood was drawn, and before long the poor creature was a mass of wounds, streaked and dripping, blind to everything but what waited somewhere ahead. And what if he found what he sought? What if he won through in his final battle, whatever that might be? What then for Traveller? "It will kill him. His reason for living, gone. Gods below, I will not bear witness to such a scene. I dare not, for I have my own obsessions." Traveller marched on in dark argument. She and Kasa rode havoc. But even this frightening beast was starting, shying as if something was bodily pushing against it, head tossed. Hoofs stamped the packed ground. Finally, after the horse almost reared, Kasa uttered a low snarl and reined in. "Down, witch," he said, as Traveller once more stalked past. "We will walk from here. But Havoc can fend for himself. When I need him, we shall find each other once more." They dismounted. Samar stretched her back. "I'm exhausted. My head feels like a wet pot in a kiln, about to explode. Kasa, stay here if you will," he said, eyes on Traveller's back. "I will go on." "Why? Wherever he's going, it's his battle, not yours. You cannot help him. You must not help him, Kasa. You see that, don't you?" He grimaced. "I can guard his back." "Why? We have journeyed together out of convenience, and that's done now. Can't you feel it? It's done. Take one wrong step, cross his path, and he will drag out that sword." She brought her hands up and pressed hard against her eyelids. Flashes of fire ignited her inner world, no different from what she was seeing in the city before them. She dropped her hands and blinked blearily at the Toblachai.
Garza, in the name of mercy, let's turn away. Leave him to whatever's in Darujistan.
Which we have been following a trail.
Sorry, what?
A trail. He glanced down at her. The hounds.
She looked again at the city, even as a fireball ripped upward and moments later thunder rolled through the ground at their feet.
The hounds. They're tearing that city apart. We can't go there. We can't walk into that.
In answer, Karsa bared his teeth.
I do not trust those beasts. Are they there to protect Traveler, or hunt him down in some deadly game in the streets?
He shook his head.
I'll not clip his heels, witch. We'll keep a respectable distance, but I will guard his back.
She wanted to scream.
You stupid, stubborn, obstinate, thick-skulled bastard! So who guards our backs?
Sudden blackness welled up inside her mind, and she must have reeled, for a moment later Karsa was holding her up, genuine concern in his face.
What ails you, Samar?
You idiot, can't you feel it?
No,
he replied. She thought he lied then, but had no energy to challenge him. That blackness had seemed vast, depthless, a maw eager to devour her, swallow her down. And most horrifying of all, something about it was seductive. Slick with sweat, her legs shaky beneath her, she held on to Karsa's arm.
Stay here, he said quietly.
No, it makes no difference.
He straightened suddenly, and she saw that he was facing the way they had come.
What is it?
That damned bear. It's back.
She twisted round. Yes, there, perhaps 100 paces away, a huge dark shape, coming no closer.
What's it want with me?
She asked in a whisper.
If you stay, you may find out, witch.
No, I said. We'll follow Traveler. It's decided.
Karsa was silent for a moment, and then he grunted.
I am thinking.
What?
You wanted to know earlier who would be guarding our backs.
She frowned and then loosed a small gasp and squinted once more at that monstrous beast. It was just hovering, huge head slowly wagging from side to side, pausing occasionally to lift its snout in their direction.
I wouldn't trust that, Karsa. I wouldn't trust that at all.
He shrugged. But still she resisted, glaring now into the vault of night overhead.
Where's the damned moon, Karsa? Where in the abyss is the damned moon?
Kalor was certain now. Forces had converged in Darujistan, clashing with deadly consequence, and blood had been spilled. He lived for such things. Sudden opportunities, unexpected powers stumbling, falling within reach, anticipation awakened within him. Life thrust forth choices, and the measure of a man or woman's worth could be found in whether they possessed the courage, the brazen decisiveness, to grasp hold and not let go. Kalor never failed such moments. Let the curse flail him, strike him down, let defeat batter him again and again, he would just get back up, shake the dust off, and begin once more. He knew the world was damned. He knew that the curse haunting him was no different from history's own progression, the endless succession of failures, the puerile triumphs that had a way of falling over as soon as one stopped looking, or caring. He knew that life itself corrected gross imbalances by simply folding everything over and starting anew. Too often, scholars and historians saw the principle of convergence with narrow, truncated focus, in terms of ascendants and gods and great powers. But Kalor understood that the events they described and pored over after the fact were but concentrated expressions of something far vaster. Entire ages converged in chaos and tumult in the anarchy of nature itself. And more often than not, very few comprehended the disaster erupting all around them. No, they simply went on day after day with their pathetic tasks, eyes to the ground, pretending that everything was just fine. Nature wasn't interested in clutching their collars and giving them a rattling shake, forcing their eyes open. No, nature just wiped them off the board. And truth be told, that was pretty much what they deserved. Not a stitch more. There were those, of course, who would view such an attitude aghast, and then accuse Kalor of being a monster devoid of compassion, a vision stained indelibly dark and all that rubbish. But they would be wrong. Compassion is not a replacement for stupidity. Tearful concern cannot stand in the stead of cold recognition. Sympathy does not cancel out the hard facts of brutal, unwavering observation. It was too easy, too cheap, to fret and wring one's hands, moaning with heartfelt empathy. It was damned self-indulgent, in fact, providing the perfect excuse for doing precisely nothing while assuming a pious pose. Enough of that. Kalor had no time for such games. A nose in the air just made it easier to cut the throat beneath it. And when it came to that choice, why, he never hesitated. As sure as any force of nature was Kalor. He walked, shins tearing and uprooting tangled grasses. Above him, a strange moonless night with the western horizon, where the sun had gone down long ago, convulsing with carmine flashes. Reaching a raised road of packed gravel, he set out, hastening his pace towards the waiting city. The track dipped and then began a long, stretched-out climb. Upon reaching the summit, he paused. 100 paces ahead, someone had set 4 torches on high poles where 4 paths met, creating a square with the flaring firelight centered on the crossroads. There were no buildings in sight, nothing to give reason for such a construction. Frowning, he resumed walking. As he drew closer, he saw someone sitting on a marker stone just beneath one of the torches, hooded, motionless, forearms resting on thighs, gauntleted hands draped down over the knees. Kalor felt a moment of unease. He scraped through gravel with one boot and saw the hood slowly lift, the figure straightening and then rising to its feet. Shit. The stranger reached up and tugged back the hood, then walked to position himself in the center of the crossroads. In the wake of recognition, dismay flooded through Kalor.
No, Spinnok Durav, not this.
The Tistandi unsheathed his sword.
High King, I cannot let you pass. Let him fight his own battles. This need not be a battle, Spinnok replied. I am camped just off this road. We can go there now, sit at a fire and drink mulled wine. And come the morning, you can turn round, go back the other way. Darudistan, High King, is not for you. You damned fool. You know you cannot best me.
He glared at the warrior, struggling. A part of him wanted to... Gods, a part of him wanted to weep.
How many of his loyal, brave followers will he see die? And for what? Listen to me, Spinnok. I have no real enmity against you, nor Rake.
He waved one chain-clad hand in the air behind him.
Not even those who pursue me. Heed me, please. I have always respected you, Spinnok. By the abyss, I railed at how Rake used you. You do not understand, the Tistandi said. You never did, Kalor. You're wrong. I have nothing against any of you. Korlat, did you think it was my intention to murder Whiskey Jack? Do you think I just cut down honorable men and loyal soldiers out of spite? You weren't even there. It was Silver Fox who needed to die, and that is a failure we shall all one day come to rue. Mark my words. Ah, God, Spinnok. They got in my way, damn you, just as you're doing now.
Spinnok sighed.
It seems there will be no mulled wine this night. Don't. I am here, High King, to stand in your way. You will die. I cannot stay my hand. Everything will be beyond control by then. Spinnok Durav, please, this does not need to happen.
The Tistandi's faint smile nearly broke Kalor's heart.
No, he understands all too well. This will be his last battle, in Rake's name, in anyone's name.
Kalor drew out his sword.
Does it occur to any of you what these things do to me? No, of course not. The High King is cursed to fail, but never to fall. The High King is but, what? Oh, the physical manifestation of ambition, walking proof of its inevitable price. Fine.
He readied his two-handed weapon.
Fuck you too.
With a roar that ripped like fire from his throat, Kalor charged forward and swung his sword. Iron rang on iron. Four torches lit the crossroads. Four torches painted two warriors locked in battle. Would these be the only witnesses? Blind and miserably indifferent with their gift of light? For now, the answer must be yes. The black water looked cold, depthless, the blood of darkness. It breathed power in chill mists that clambered ashore to swallow jagged, broken rocks, fallen trees. Night itself seemed to be raining down into this sea. Glittering rings spun and clicked, and Clips slowly turned to face Nimanda and the others.
I can use this, he said. The power rising from this water, it is filled with currents of pure Kurald Galain. I can use this.
A gate?
Well, at least one of you is thinking. A gate, yes, Nimanda, a gate, to take us to Black Coral.
How close? Skintik asked. Clip shrugged.
Close enough. We will see. At the very least, within sight of the city walls.
So get on with it, said Nenander, his words very nearly a snarl.
Smiling, Clip faced the cut once more.
Do not speak, any of you. I must work hard at this.
Nimanda rubbed at his face. He felt numb, haunted by exhaustion. He moved off to sit on a boulder. Just up from the steep shoreline, thick moss blunted everything. The stumps of rotted trees, the upended roots, the tumbled black stones. The night air clung to him, cold and damp, reaching into his bones, closing tight about his heart. He listened to the soft lap of the water, the suck and gurgle among the rocks. The smell was rich with decay, the mist sweet with brine. He could feel the cold of the boulder seeping through, and his hands ached. Clip spun his chain, whirled the two rings, one gold, one silver, and round they went. Apart from that, he stood motionless, his back to them all. Skintik settled down beside Nimanda. Their eyes met, and Skintik shrugged a silent question, to which Nimanda replied with a faint shake of his head. He'd thought he'd have a few more days to decide things, the when, the how, the options if they should fail. Tactics, fallback plans. So much to think about, but he could speak to no one, could not even hint of what he thought must be done. Clip had stayed too close to them on this descent, as if suspicious, as if deliberately forcing Nimanda to say nothing. There was so much he needed to tell them, and so much that he needed to hear. Discussions, arguments, the weighing of risks and contingencies and coordination. All the things demanded of one who would lead, but his inability to give voice to his intentions, to deliver orders at the end of a long debate, had made him next to useless. By his presence alone, Clip had stopped Nimanda in his tracks. In this game of move and countermove, Clip had outwitted him, and that galled. The moment the charade was shattered, there would be chaos, and in that scene Clip held the advantage. He had only himself to worry about, after all. No, Nimanda had no choice but to act alone, to trust in the others to follow. He knew they were watching him, his every move, studying his face for any telltale expression, for every silent message, and this meant he had to hold himself in check. He had to guard himself against revealing anything, lest one of them misunderstand and so make a fatal mistake, and all of this was wearing him down. Something lifted noisily from the black water. A span of darkness, vertical, its upper edges dripping, fast dissolving.
Follow me, Clip gasped. Quickly!
Nimanda rose and tugged Skintik back.
Everyone, stay behind me!
And seeing Clip lunge forward and vanish within the gate, he hurried forward. But Nimanda reached the portal before him, rushing in even as he drew his sword. Cursing under his breath, Nimanda darted after him. The gate was collapsing. Someone shrieked in his wake. Nimanda staggered on slippery, uneven bedrock, half blinded by streaks of luminescence that scattered like cut webs. He heard a gasping sound almost at his feet, and a moment later stumbled against something that groaned. Nimanda reached down, felt a body lying prone, felt something hot and welling under one palm, the slit of a wound, the leaking of blood.
Nimanda?
Another gasp, and then,
I'm sorry, Nemanda. I saw him reaching for his dagger, even as he stepped through. I saw... He knew you were following, you see. He...
From somewhere ahead there came a hollow laugh.
Do you imagine me an idiot, Nemanda? Too bad it wasn't you. It should have been you. But then, this way, it's just one more death for you to carry along.
Nemanda stared, but could see nothing.
You still need us!
Maybe, but it's too risky to have you so close. When I see a viper, I don't invite it into my belt pouch. So, wander lost in here forever, Nemanda. It won't feel very different from your life before this, I expect.
The god within you, Nemanda said, is a fool. My lord will cut it down, and you with it, Clip. You don't know him. You don't know a damned thing.
Another laugh, this one much farther away. Nemanda wiped the tears from his cheeks with his free forearm. Beneath his palm, the pulse of blood from the wound had slowed. Too many failures, too many defeats. A soul carries a vessel of courage. It cannot be refilled. Everything that takes from it leaves less behind. What do I have left? Whatever it was, the time had come to drink deep, to use it all. One last time. Nemanda straightened.
Desra, Skintik, anyone?
His words drew echoes, and they were the only replies he received. Nemanda drew his sword and then set out, in the direction of that mocking laughter. Ribbons of light swam in the air on all sides. He encountered no walls, felt no wayward currents of air. The folded bedrock beneath his feet undulated randomly, angling neither upward nor downward for long, uneven enough to make him stumble every now and then, and once to land on his knees with a painful, stinging jolt. Lost. Not a single sound to betray where Clip might be now. Yes, this was a clever end for Nemanda, one that must have given Clip moments of delicious anticipation. Lost in darkness, lost to his kin, to his lord, and to a future that now would never arrive. So perfect, so precise, this punishment.
Enough of that, you pathetic creature.
Fayed.
They're here, you fool, as lost as you.
What? Who? Leave me be. I told you I'm sorry. For what happened to you, for what I tried to do, I'm sorry.
Too late for that. Besides, you don't understand. I lived in fear. I lived in perpetual terror of everything, of all of you, that I'd be found out. Can you imagine, Nemanda, what that was like? To live was torture, to dread an end even worse. Oh, I knew it was coming. It had to. People like me win for only so long before someone notices, and then his face fills with disgust and he crushes me underfoot. Or throws me out of a window.
Please, no more.
They're here. Desra, Skintik, sweet Aranatha. Find them.
How?
I can't do this for you. Shouts will go unheard. There are layers to this place. Layers and layers and layers. You could have walked right through one of them and known nothing. Nemanda Gollit, the blood of our Lord is within you. The blood of Elaint, too. Is that the secret? Is that the one weapon Clip did not know you possess? How could he know? How could anyone? We have suppressed it within ourselves for so long now.
Because Andaris told us to.
Because Andaris told us to. Because he was bitter and hurting. He thought he could take his brother's children and make them his own, more his own than Rake's.
Nananda.
Had the thinnest blood of all. We knew that. You knew it, too. It made him too predictable. It's probably killed him. Brother, father, son, these layers are so precious, aren't they? Look on them again, my lover, my killer, but this time with a dragon's eyes.
But Fayed, I don't know how. How do I do that?
She had no answer. No, it would never be that simple, would it? Fayed was not an easy memory, not a gentle ghost, nor his wise conscience. She was none of that. Just one more kin whose blood stained Nemanda's hands. He had stopped walking. He stood now surrounded by oblivion.
My hands,
he whispered, and then slowly lifted them.
Stained,
he said.
Yes, stained.
The blood of kin, the blood of Tistandi.
The blood of dragons. That shines like beacons. That call, summon, can cast outward until...
A woman's hand reached out as if from nowhere, closing round one of his own in a cold grip. And all at once she was before him, her eyes like twin veils, parting to reveal a depthless, breathtaking love. He gasped, vertiginous, and almost reeled.
Aranatha,
she said.
There is little time, brother. We must hurry.
Still holding his hand, she set off, pulling him along as she might a child. But Nemanda was of no mind to complain. He had looked into her eyes. He had seen it, that love. He had seen it. And more, he had understood. The dying god, he was coming. Pure as music, bright as truth, solid as certainty. A fist of power driving onward, smashing everything in its path, until that fist uncurled and the hand opened to close round the soul of the Redeemer. A weaker god, a god lost in its own confusion. Salind would be that fist, she would be that hand, delivering a gift from which a true and perfect faith would emerge.
This is the blood of redemption. You will understand, Redeemer. Drink deep the blood of redemption and dance. The song is glory, and glory is a world we need never leave. And so, my beloved Itkovian, dance with me. Here, see me reaching for you.
Supine on the muddy floor of Gradithan's hut, Salind leaked thick black mucus from her mouth and nose, from the tear ducts of her eyes. Her fingernails were black, and more inky fluid oozed out of them. She was naked, and as he knelt beside her, Gradithan had paused, breathing hard, his eyes fixed on the black milk trickling down from the woman's nipples. Standing wrapped in his rain cape close to the doorway, Monkrat looked on with flat eyes, his face devoid of expression. He could see how Gradithan struggled against the sudden thirst, the desire that was half childlike and half sexual, as he stared down at those leaking breasts. The bastard had already raped her in some twisted consummation, a sacrifice of her virginity, so the only thing that must have been holding the man back was some kind of overriding imperative. Monkrat was not happy thinking about that. Gradithan lifted Salin's head with one hand and tugged open her mouth with the other. He reached for the jug of Semen Kellic.
Time, he muttered, and time, 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 the time is now.
He tipped the jug and the black juice poured into Salin's gaping, stained mouth. She swallowed and swallowed, and it seemed she would never stop, that her body was depthless, a vessel with no bottom. She drank down her need, and that need could never find satiation. Monkrat grunted. He'd known plenty of people like that. It was a secret poorly kept once you knew what to look for, there in their eyes. Hope and expectation and hunger and the hint of spiteful rage should a single demand be denied. They had a way of appearing and then never leaving. Yes, he'd known people like that. And, well, here was their god, shining from Salin's eyes. Everyone needed a god. Slapped together and shaped with frantic hands, a thing of clay and sticks, built up of wants and all those unanswerable questions that plagued the mortal soul. Neuroses carved in stone, malign obsessions given a hard, judgmental face. He had seen them, all the variations, in city after city, on the long campaigns of the Malazan Empire. They lined the friezes in temples. They leered down from balustrades. 10,000 gods. One for every damned mood, it seemed, a pantheon of exaggerated flaws. Salind was convulsing now, the black poison gushing from her mouth, thick as honey down her chin, and hanging in drop-heavy threads like some ghastly beard. When she smiled, Monkrat flinched. The convulsions found a rhythm, and Gradithan was pushed away as she undulated upright, a serpent rising, a thing of sweet venom. Monkrat edged back, and before Gradithan could turn to him, the ex-bridge-burner slipped outside. Rain slanted down into his face. He paused, ankle-deep in streaming mud, and drew up his hood. That water had felt clean, if only it could wash all of this away. Oh, not the camp, it was already doing that, but everything else. Choices made, bad decisions stumbled into, years of useless living. Would he ever do anything right? His list of errors had grown so long he felt trapped by some internal pell-mell momentum. Dozens more awaited him. A bedraggled shape emerged from the rain, grizzled face, a sopping hair shirt. Like some damned haunt from his past, a ghoul grinning with dread reminders of everything he'd thrown away. Spindle stepped up to Monkrat.
It's time.
For what? Aye, we got drunk. We laughed and cried and all that shit. And maybe I told you too much, but not enough, I'm now thinking, if you believe you can do a damned thing about all this. It's a god we're talking about here, Spin. A god!
Never mind that. I've been walking through this shithole. Monkrat, there's children here, just abandoned. Not for long. They're going to be taken, used to feed the dying god. Not if we take them first.
Take them? Where?
Spindle bared his teeth, and only now did Monkrat comprehend the barely restrained fury in the man facing him.
Where? How about away? Does that sound too complicated for you? Maybe those hills west of here, in the woods. You said it was all coming down. If we leave them, they'll all die, and I won't have it.
Monkrat scratched at his beard.
Now ain't that admirable of you, but...
The hard, angled point of a short sword pressed the soft flesh below Monkrat's chin. He scowled. The bastard was fast, all right, and old Monkrat was losing his edge.
Now, hissed Spindle, you either follow Gredithick around...
Gredithan.
Whatever. You either follow him like a pup, or you start helping me round up the runts still alive.
You're giving me a choice?
Kind of. If you say you want to be a pup, then I'll saw off your head as clumsily as I can.
Monkrat hesitated. Spindle's eyes widened.
You're in a bad way, soldier.
I ain't a soldier no more.
Maybe that's your problem. You've forgotten things, important things. Such as?
Spindle grimaced, as if searching for the right words, and Monkrat saw in his mind a quick image of a three-legged dog chasing rabbits in a field.
Fine, Spindle finally said in a grating tone. It had to have happened to you at least once, you and your squad. You come into some rotten foul village or hamlet. You come to buy food or maybe get your tack fixed, clothes mended, whatever. But you ain't there to kill nobody. And so you get into a few conversations in the tavern, the smithy, with the whores, and they start talking about injustices, bastard landholders, local bullies, shit-grinning small-time tyrants, the usual crap, the corruption and all that. You know what I'm talking about, Monkrat?
Sure.
So what did you do?
We hunted the scum down and flayed their asses. Sometimes we even strung them up.
Spindle nodded.
You did justice, is what you did. It's what a soldier can do when there's nobody else. We got swords, we got armor, we got all we need to terrorize anybody we damned well please. But Dasem taught us. He taught every soldier in the Malazan armies back then. Sure, we had swords, but who we used them on was up to us.
The point of the short sword fell away.
We were soldiers, Monkrat. We had the chance, the privilege, of doing the right thing.
I deserted.
And I was forced into retirement. Neither one changes what we were.
That's where you're wrong.
Then listen to this.
The short sword pressed against his throat again.
I can still deliver justice, and if need be, I'll do it right now and right here, by cutting a coward's head off.
Don't talk to me about cowardice,
Monkrat snapped.
Soldiers don't talk that ever. You just broke the first rule.
Someone turns his back on being a soldier. On what it means in the soul. That's cowardice. You don't like the word, don't live it.
Monkrat stared into the man's eyes and hated what he saw there. He sagged.
Best get on with it then, Spin. I got nothing left. I'm used up. What do you do when the soldier inside you dies before you do? Tell me. You go through the motions, Monkrat. You just follow me. Do as I do. We start there and worry about the rest later.
Monkrat realized that Spindle was still waiting.
Do what's right, Dasim told us.
Gods, even after all this time, he still remembered the First Sword's words.
That's a higher law than the command of any officer, higher even than the Emperor's own words. You are in a damned uniform, but that's not a license to deliver terror to everyone, just the enemy soldier you happen to be facing. Do what is right, for that armor you wear doesn't just protect your flesh and bone. It defends honor, it defends integrity, it defends justice. Soldiers, heed me well. That armor defends humanity. And when I look upon my soldiers, when I see these uniforms, I see compassion and truth. The moment those virtues fail, then the gods help you, for no armor is strong enough to save you.
All right, Spin, I'll follow you.
A sharp nod.
Dasim, he'd be proud. And not surprised, no, not surprised at all. We have to watch out for Gradithan. He wants those virgins, he wants their blood for when the dying god arrives.
Yeah? Well, Greddy shit can chew on Hood's arsehole. He ain't getting them.
A moment ago I was thinking, Spin.
Thinking what?
That you was a three-legged dog. But I was wrong. You're a damned hound of shadow is what you are. Come on, I know where they all huddle to stay out of the rain.
Cyrodiil adjusted the grip on his sword and then glanced back at the Redeemer. The god's position was unchanged, kneeling, half bent over, face hidden behind his hands. A position of abject submission, defeat and despair. Hardly an inspiring standard to stand in front of, hardly a thing to fight for, and Cyrodiil could feel the will draining from him as he faced once more the woman dancing in the basin. Convulsing clouds overhead, an endless rain of Kellic that turned everything black. The drops stung and then numbed his eyes. He had ceased to flinch from the crack of lightning, a stuttering crash of thunder. He had fought for something unworthy once, and had vowed never again. Yet here he was, standing between a god of unimaginable power and a god not worth believing in. One wanted to feed, and the other looked ready to be devoured. Why should he get in the way of the two? A wretched gasp from the Redeemer snapped him round. The rain painted it Covian black, ran like dung-stained water down the face he had lifted skyward.
Dying,
he murmured, so faint that Cyrodiil had to step closer to catch the word.
But no end is desired. Dying for all eternity. Who seeks this fate for himself? Who yearns for such a thing? Can I help him?
Cyrodiil staggered back, as if struck by a blow to his chest.
That, Beru Fend, that is not a proper question, not against this thing. Look to yourself, Redeemer. You cannot heal what does not want healing. You cannot mend what delights in being broken. You cannot, he growled. You cannot help it, Redeemer. You can only fall to it. Fall, vanish, be swallowed up.
He wants me. She wants me. She gave him this want, do you see? Now they share her.
Cyrodiil turned to gaze upon the High Priestess. She was growing more arms, each bearing a weapon, each weapon whirling and spinning in a clashing web of edged iron. Kellic sprayed from the blades, a whirling cloud of droplets. Her dance was carrying her closer. The attack was beginning.
Who, Cyrodiil whispered, will share this with me?
Find her, said the Redeemer. She remains deep inside, drowning but alive. Find her.
Selind, she is nothing to me.
She is the fire in Spinok Durav's heart. She is his life. Fight not for me. Fight not for yourself. Fight, Cyrodiil, for your friend.
A sob was wrenched from the warrior. His soul found a voice, and that voice wailed its anguish. Gasping, he lifted his sword and set his eyes upon the woman cavorting in her dance of carnage.
Can I do this? Spinok Durav, you fool, how could you have fallen so? Can I find her? I don't know. I don't think so.
But his friend had found love. Absurd, ridiculous love. His friend, wherever he was, deserved a chance. For the only gift that meant a damned thing, the only one. Blinking black tears from his eyes, Seardamin went down to meet her. Her howl of delight was a thing of horror. A soldier could discover, in one horrendous, crushing moment, that everything that lay at the heart of duty was a lie, a rotted, fetid mass, feeding like a cancer on all that the soldier was, and that every virtue was rooted in someone else's poison. Look to the poor fool at your side. Know well there's another poor fool at your back. This is how far the world shrinks down, when everything else melts in front of your eyes, too compromised to sustain clear vision, the brutal, uncluttered recognition of the lie. Torn loose from the Malazan Empire, from one arm's host, the bedraggled clutch of survivors that was all that remained of the bridge burners had dragged their sorry backsides to Darujistan. They found for themselves a cave where they could hide, surrounded by a handful of familiar faces to remind them of what had pushed them each step of the way, from the past to the present. And hoping it would be enough to take them into the future, one hesitant, wayward step at a time. Slash knives into the midst of that meager, vulnerable clutch, and it just falls apart. Mallet, blue pearl, like blindfolded goats dragged up to the altar stone. Not that goats needed blindfolds, it's just no fun looking into a dying animal's eyes. Picker fell through darkness. Maybe she was flesh and bone, maybe she was nothing but a soul, torn loose and now plummeting with naught but the weight of its own regrets. But her arms scythed through bitter cold air, her legs kicked out to find purchase where none existed, and each breath was getting harder to snatch from that rushing blast. In the dream world, every law could be twisted round, bent, folded. And so, as she sensed the unseen ground fast approaching, she spun herself upright and slowed, sudden and yet smooth, and moments later she landed lightly on uneven bedrock. Snail shells crunched underfoot, she heard the faint snap of small rodent bones. Blinking, gasping one breath after another deep into her lungs, she simply stood for a time, knees slightly flexed, hands out to her sides. She could smell an animal stench, thick, as if she found herself in a den in some hillside. The darkness slowly faded. She saw rock walls on which scenes had been pecked, others painted in earthy hues. She saw the half-shells of gourds crowding the rough floor on both sides. She had landed upon a sort of path, reaching ahead and behind, perhaps 3 paces wide. Before her, 6 or 7 paces away, it ended in a stone wall. Behind her, the trail blended into darkness. She looked once more at the objects cluttering the flanks. In each gourd, there was thick, dark liquid. She knew instinctively that it was blood. The image etched into the wall in front, where the path ended, now snared her attention, and slowly its details began to resolve. A carriage or wagon, a swarm of vague shapes all reaching up for it on both sides, with others hinted at in its wake. A scene of frenzy and panic, the figure sitting on the bench holding reins that seemed to whip about, but no, her mind was playing tricks in this faint light, and that sound, as of wheels slamming and rocking and spinning over broken ground, was only her lunging heart, the rush of blood in her ears. But Picker stared, transfixed. A soldier with nothing left to believe in is a terrible thing to behold. When the blood on the hands is unjust blood, the soul withers. Death becomes a lover, and that love leads to but one place. Every time, but one place. Friends and family watch on, helpless. And in this tragic scene, the liars, the cynical bearers of poison, they are nowhere to be found. Endest Silan had once been a priest, a believer in forces beyond the mortal realm, a believer in the benign regard of ancestors, spirits, each one a moral lodestone that cut through the dissembling, the evasions of responsibility, the denials of culpability. A man of faith, yes, in the traditional sense of the word. But these things no longer found harbor in his soul. Ancestors dissolved into the ground, leaving nothing but crumbling flecks of bone in dark earth. Spirits offered no gifts, and those still clinging to life were bitter and savage, too often betrayed, too often spat upon, to hold any love for anyone. He now believed that mortals were cursed. Some innate proclivity led them again and again on the same path. Mortals betrayed every gift granted them. They betrayed the giver. They betrayed their own promises, their gods, their ancestors, their children, everywhere betrayal. The great forests of Carcanus had been cut down. The squalid, dying islands of growth left behind had each one fallen to fire or blight. The rich soils washed down into the rivers. The flesh of the land was stripped back to reveal bedrock bones. And hunger stalked the children. Mothers wailed, fathers tried on hardened masks of resolve. But before any of this, both had looked out upon the ravaged world with affronted disbelief. Someone's to blame, someone always is, but by the abyss, do not look at me. But there was nowhere else to look. Mother Dark had turned away. She had left them to fates of their own devising, and in so doing she had taken away their privilege of blaming someone else. Such was a godless world. One might think, then, that a people would rise to fullest height, stand proud, and accept the notion of potential culpability for each decision made or not made. Yes, that would be nice. That would be something to behold, to feed riotous optimism. But such a moment, such stature, never came. Enlightened ages belonged to the past or waited for the future. Such ages acquired the gloss of iconic myth, reduced to abstractions. The present world was real, filled with the grit of reality and compromise. People did not stand tall. They ducked. There was no one about with whom Endest Silan could discuss all this, no one who might, just might, understand the significance of what he was thinking. Rush headlong. Things are happening. Standing stones topple one against another, and on and on. Tidal surges lift ever higher, smoke and screams and violence and suffering. Victims piled in heaps like the plunder of cannibals. This is the meat of glee, the present made breathless, impatience burning like acid. Who has time to comprehend? Endest Silan stood atop the lesser tower of the keep. He held out one hand, knuckles to the earth, as black rain pooled in the cup of his palm. Was the truth as miserable as it seemed? Did it all demand that one figure, one solitary figure, rise to stand tall? To face that litany of destruction, the brutality of history, the lie of progress, the desecration of a home once sacred, precious beyond imagining? One figure, alone?
Is his own burden not enough? Why must he carry ours? Why have we done this to him? Why, because it's easier that way, and we so cherish the easy paths, do we not? The least of effort defines our virtues. Trouble us not, for we dislike being troubled. The children are hungry, the forests are dead, the rivers poisoned. Calamity descends again and again. Diseases flower like mushrooms on corpses, and soon we will war over what's left, as we did in Carcanus. He will take this burden, but what does that mean? That we are freed to stay unchanging? Freed to continue doing nothing?
The black water overflowed the cup, spilled down to become rain once more. Even the High Priestess did not understand. Not all of it, no. She saw this as a single desperate gambit, a cast of the knuckles on which rode everything. But if it failed, well, there'd be another game. New players. The same old tired rules. The wealth wagered never lost its value, did it? The heap of golden coins will not crumble. It will only grow bigger yet.
Then, if the players come and go, while the rules never change, does not that heap in fact command the game? Would you bow to this god of gold, this insensate illusion of value? Bow, then. Press forehead to the hard floor, but when it all goes wrong, show me no affronted disbelief.
Yes, Anamanda Rake would take that burden and carry it into a new world, but he would offer no absolution. He would deliver but one gift, an undeserved one, and that was time. The most precious privilege of all.
And what, pray tell, shall we do with it?
Off to his left, surmounting a much higher tower, A dragon fixed slitted eyes upon a decrepit camp beyond the veil of night. No rain could blind it. No excuse could brave its unwavering regard. Celaena watched and waited. But the waiting was almost over. Rush, then, to this feast. Rush, ye hungry ones, to the meat of glee. The wall had never been much to begin with. Dismantled in places, unfinished in others, it would never have withstood a siege for any length of time. Despite its execrable condition, the breach made by the Hounds of Shadow was obvious. An entire gate was gone, filled with the flame-licked wreckage of the blockhouses and a dozen nearby structures. Figures now clambered in its midst, hunting survivors, fighting the flames. Beyond it, vast sections of the city, where heaving clouds of smoke lifted skyward, lit bright by raging gas fires, suddenly ebbed, as if Darujistan's very breath had been snatched away. Samardev staggered, fell to her knees. The pressure closing about her head felt moments from crushing the plates of her skull. She cried out even as Karsa crouched down beside her. Ahead, Traveler had swung away from the destroyed gate, seeking instead another portal to the east, through which terrified refugees now spilled out into the ramshackle neighborhood of shanties, where new fires had erupted from knocked-down shacks and in the wake of fleeing squatters. How Traveler intended to push his way through that mob.
Witch, you must concentrate.
What?
In your mind, raise a wall on all sides. Make it strong. Give it the power to withstand the one who has arrived.
She pulled away from his hand.
Who? Who has arrived? By the spirits, I can't stand.
He slapped her, hard enough to knock her down. Stunned, she stared up at him.
Samardev, I do not know who or what. It is not the Hounds, not even Shadow Throne. Someone is there, and that someone blazes. I cannot imagine such a being.
A god,
he shrugged.
Build your walls.
The pressure had eased, and she wondered at that, and then realized that Karsa had moved round, placing himself between her and the city. She saw sweat running down the Toblakai's face, streaming like rain. She saw the tightness in his eyes.
Karsa,
if we are to follow, you and me both, then you must do this. Build walls, witch, and hurry.
His gaze lifted to something behind her, and all at once she felt a breath of power at her back, gusting against her, sinking past clothes, past skin, through flesh, and then deep into her bones. She gasped. The pressure was pushed back, left to rage against immense barriers now shielding her mind. She climbed to her feet. Side by side, they set out after Traveler. He was cutting across a ragged strip of fallow field, dust rising with each stride, making for the gate at a sharp angle. The surging mob of people blocking the portal seemed to melt back, and she wondered what those refugees had seen in Traveler's face as he marched straight for them. Whatever it had been, clearly it was not something to be challenged. A strange, diffuse light now painted the city, the uneven wall, the domes, minarets, and spires visible behind it. From 1,000 throats erupted a moaning wail of shock, of dread. She saw faces lift one by one. She saw eyes widen. Grunting, Karsa glanced back and then halted.
Gods below!
She spun. A giant bear loomed 20 or so paces back, its outline limned by a silver light. And that light... The moon had finally clambered free of the horizon, but it was...
Queen of dreams.
Shattered, Karsa said. The moon has shattered. Faces in the rock! What has happened?
What rose now into the sky was a mass of fragments, torn apart amidst a cloud of thin rings of dust. It had expanded in its eruption and was now twice its normal size. Huge chunks were visibly spiraling away from the center. The light it cast was sickly yet astonishingly bright. The monstrous bear had half turned and was lifting its snout towards that devastated world, as if it was capable of smelling death across the span of countless leagues. Karsa tugged at Samardev.
He is in the city, witch. We cannot lose him.
she permitted him to drag her along, her hand enveloped by his. Perched in a niche close to the gate, Chilbays tracked the one known as Traveller. The demon was shaking uncontrollably. The bellowing of hounds, the detonations of entire buildings, the arrival of the Son of Darkness and the slaying of a god, oh, any of these could have been sufficient cause for such quivering terror. Even that ruined moon thrusting skyward to the south. Alas, however, it was none of these that had elicited the winged toad's present state of abject extremity. No, the source was threading through the crowd at the gate, now passing beneath the arch, the one named Traveller. Oh, he held in so much of himself, a will of such breathtaking intensity that Chilbays imagined it could, if the man so desired, reach into the heavens, close about all those spinning pieces in the sky, and remake the entire moon. But this was not a healing power. This was not a benign will. The hounds howled anew, announcing all that they had sensed, all that they even now reeled away from. Goaded, they lashed out in all directions, killing with mindless frenzy, and once more madness was unleashed upon the hapless people of Darujistan. Oh, the master would be furious at this loss of control, most furious. Chilbays opened his mouth and managed an impossibly broad grin, a smile to the crazed night sky. The demon worked its way out of the niche and flapped its wings a few times to work out the folds. Then it sprang into the air. Plunging into the milling crowd was not part of the plan, and the panic that ensued seemed out of all proportion to this modest demon's unexpected arrival. After some hectic moments, Chilbays succeeded in flapping upward once more, bruised and scraped, scratched and scuffed, winging his way to the estate of his master, eager to deliver a message.
"He is here! He is here! Dasim Ultor is here! Can I leave now?"
Both Karsa and Samardev had witnessed the demon's plight, but neither made comment, even as it winged back up to vanish over the wall. They were rushing, Karsa Orlong imposing enough to clear a path, straight for the gate. A short time later they stumbled through, out onto a broad avenue into which citizens streamed from every conceivable direction. They saw travellers 60 or so paces ahead, reaching an intersection oddly empty of refugees. Those figures nearest it were running in blind panic. Traveller had halted, a solitary figure bathed in the light of the shattered moon. A hound trotted into view on the warrior's left. A mangled, headless torso hung in its jaws, still draining thick blood. Its lambent eyes were on Traveller, who had not moved, although it was clear that he was tracking the beast with his gaze. Karsa unsheathed his sword and quickened his pace. Samardev, her heart pounding, hurried after him. She saw the Toblakai slow suddenly, and then stop, still 30 paces from the intersection, and a moment later she saw why. Cotillion was walking up to Traveller. Another hound, the black one, had appeared to guard the god's other flank. Behind them, a distant building suddenly crashed down, and in the heart of that thunder there was the sound of two beasts locked in mortal combat, neither yielding. Frail screams echoed in fragile counterpoint. Traveller waited. Cotillion came to stand directly in front of him and began to speak. Samardev wanted to rush forward, at least to a spot from where she could overhear the god, catch whatever response Traveller delivered. But Karsa's hand held her back, and he shook his head, saying in a murmur, "This is not for us, witch." Traveller seemed to be refusing something, stepping back, looking away. Cotillion pressed on. "He does not want it," Karsa said. "Whatever he asks, Traveller does not want it." Yes, she could see that.
"Please, I need to—"
"No.
Karsa—"
"What drives you is want, not need."
"Fine, then. I'm a nosy bitch. Just leave me to it."
"No. This is between them, and so it must remain. Samardev, answer me this. If you could hear what they say, if you comprehended all that it might mean, would you be able to stay silent?" She bristled and then hissed in frustration.
"I'm not very good at doing that, am I? All right, Karsa, but what if I did say something? What harm would that do?"
"Leave him," said Karsa. "Leave him free to choose for himself." Whatever Cotillion was saying seemed to strike like physical blows, which Traveller absorbed one after another, still looking away, still clearly unable to meet the god's eyes. The hound with the chewed-up torso was now eating it with all the mindless intensity common to carnivores filling their stomachs. The other beast had half turned away and seemed to be listening to that distant fight. Cotillion was unrelenting. For the god, for Traveller, and for Samar Dev and Karsa Orlong, the world beyond this scene had virtually vanished. A moment was taking portentous shape, hewn one piece at a time, like finding a face in the heart of a block of stone. A moment that spun on some kind of decision, one that Traveller must make, here, now, for it was obvious that Cotillion had placed himself in the warrior's path and would not step to one side.
Karsa, if this goes wrong...
I have his back, said the Toblakai in a growl.
But what if...
An inhuman cry from Traveller cut through her words, cut through every thought, slashing like a knife. Such a forlorn, desperate sound. It did not belong to him, could not, but he had thrust out one arm, as if to shove Cotillion aside. They stood too far apart for that, yet Cotillion, now silent, simply stepped away from Traveller's path. And the warrior walked past, but now it was as if each boot needed to be dragged forward, as if Traveller now struggled against some terrible invisible tide. That ferocious obsession seemed to have come untethered. He walked as would a man lost. Cotillion watched him go, and she saw him lift a forearm to his eyes, as if he did not want the memory of this, as if he could wipe it away with a single private gesture. Although she did not understand, sorrow flooded through Samardev. Sorrow for whom? She had no answer that made sense. She wanted to weep, for Traveller, for Cotillion, for Karsa.
For this damned city and this damned night?
The hounds had trotted off. She blinked. Cotillion, too, had disappeared. Karsa shook himself and then led her onward once more. The pressure was building, leaning in on her defences. She sensed cracks, the sifting of dust. And as they stumbled along in Traveller's wake, Samar Dev realized that the warrior was marching straight for the nexus of that power. The taste of fear was bitter on her tongue.
No, Traveller, no. Change your mind. Change it, please.
But he would not do that, would he? Would not, could not.
The fate of the fated. Oh, that sounds clumsy. And yet, what else can it be called? This force of inevitability, both willed and unwilling, both unnecessary and inexorable. The fate of the fated.
Walking through a city trapped in a nightmare, beneath the ghoulish light of a moon in its death throes, Traveller might as well be dragging chains, and at the ends of those chains, none other than Karsa Orlong and Samar Dev. And Traveller might as well be wearing his own collar of iron, something invisible but undeniable heaving him forward. She had never felt so helpless. In the eternity leading up to the moment of the Lord of Death's arrival, the world of Dragnipur had begun a slow, deadly, and seemingly unstoppable convulsion. Everywhere the looming promise of annihilation. Everywhere a chorus of desperate cries, bellowing rage and hopeless defiance. The raw nature of each chained thing was awakened, and each gave that nature voice, and each voice held the flavor of sharp truth. Dragons shrilled, demons roared, fools shrieked in hysteria. Bold heroes and murderous thugs snatched deep breaths that made ribs creak, and then loosed battle cries. Argent fires were tumbling down from the sky, tearing down through clouds of ash. An army of unimaginable size, from which no quarter was possible, had begun a lumbering charge, and weapons clashed the rims of shields, and this white, rolling wave of destruction seemed to surge higher, as if seeking to merge with the storm clouds. Feeble, eroded shapes dragged along at the ends of chains now flopped blunted limbs as if to fend off the fast-closing oblivion. Eyes rolled in battered skulls, remnants of life and of knowledge flickering one last time. No, nothing wanted to die. When death is oblivion, life will spit in its face, if it can. The sentient and the mindless were now, finally, all of one mind.
Shake awake all reason, These gathered instincts are not the end, but the means. Rattle the chains if you must, but know that that which binds does not break, and the path is never as wayward as one might believe.
Ditch stared with one eye into the descending heavens, and knew terror, but that terror was not his. The god that saw with the same eye filled Ditch's skull with its shrieks.
Born to die! I am born to die! I am born to die! Not fair, not fair, not fair!
And Ditch just rattled a laugh, or at least imagined that he did so, and replied,
We're all born to die, you idiot! Let the span last a single heartbeat. Let it last 1,000 years. Stretch the heartbeat out. Crush down the centuries. It's no different. They feel the same when the end arrives. Gods, they feel the same.
No, he was not much impressed by this godling cowering in his soul. Cataspala was mad, mad to think such a creation could achieve anything. Etch deep into its heart this ferocious hunger to kill, and then reveal the horror of its helplessness. Oh, was that not cruel beyond all reason? Was that not its own invitation to insanity?
Cataspala, you have but made versions of yourself. You couldn't help it. Yes, I see that. But damn you, my flesh belonged to me, not you. Damn you!
But curses meant nothing now. Every fate was now converging.
Ha ha! Take that, you pious posers, and you arrogant shits, and all you whining victims! See what comes! It's all the same, this end, all the same!
And here he was, trapped in the greater scheme, his skin a piece of a tapestry, and its grand scene a pattern he could never read. The demon pearl stood wearing bodies from which a forest of iron roots swept down in loops and coils. It could carry no more, and so it stood, softly weeping, its legs like two failing trunks that shook and trembled. It had long since weighed the value of hatred. For the high mage Taishren, who first summoned it and bound it to his will, for Ben Adifon Dalat, who unleashed it against the Son of Darkness, and for Anamanda Rake himself, whose sword bit deep. But the value was an illusion. Hate was a lie that in feeding fills the hater with the bliss of satiation, even as his spirit starves. No, Pearl did not hate. Life was a negotiation between the expected and the unexpected. One made do. Draconis staggered up.
Pearl, my friend, I have come to say goodbye, and to tell you I am sorry.
What saddens you? The demon asked.
I am sorry, Pearl, for all of this, for Dragnipur, for the horror forged by my own hands. It was fitting, was it not, that the weapon claimed its maker? I think, yes, it was. It was.
He paused, and then brought both hands up to his face. For a moment it seemed he would begin clawing his beard from the skin beneath it. Instead, the shackled hands fell away, down, dragged by the weight of the chains.
I too am sorry, said Pearl, to see the end of this.
What?
So many enemies, all here and not one by choice. Enemies and yet working together for so long. It was a wondrous thing, was it not, Draconis? When necessity forced each hand to clasp, to work as one? A wondrous thing.
The warrior stared at the demon. He seemed unable to speak. Apsalara worked her way along the top of the beam. It was hard to hold on, the wagon pitching and rocking so with one last useless surge forward, and the beam itself thick with the slime of sweat, blood, and runny mucus. But something was happening at the portal, that black icy stain beneath the very center of the wagon. A strange stream was flowing into the gate, an intricate pattern ebbing down through the fetid air from the underside of the wagon's bed. Each tendril was inky black, the space around it ignited by a sickly glow that pulsed slower than any mortal heart. Was it Cataspala's pathetic god, seeking to use the tattooist's insane masterpiece as if it was a latticework, a mass of rungs down which it could clamber and so plunge through the gate, seeking to escape? If so, then she intended to make use of it first. Let the cold burn her flesh. Let pieces of her simply fall away. It was a better end than some snarling manifestation of chaos ripping out her throat. She struggled ever closer, her breath sleeting out in crackling plumes that sank down in sparkling ice crystals. It reminded her of her youth, the nights out on the tundra, when the first snows came, when clouds shivered and shed their diamond skins, and the world grew so still, so breathless and perfect, that she felt that time itself was but moments from freezing solid. To hold her forever in that place, hold her youth, hold tight her dreams and ambitions, her memories of the faces she loved, her mother, her father, her kin, her lovers. No one would grow old, no one would die and fall away from the path. And the path itself, why, it would never end.
Leave me in mid-step, my foot never to settle, never to edge me forward that much closer to the end of things. Yes, leave me here, at the very heart of possibilities, not one of which will crash down. No failures to come, no losses, no regrets to kiss upon the lips. I will not feel the cold. I will not feel the cold.
She cried out in the frigid, deathly air. Such pain. How could she ever get close enough? Apsalara drew herself up, knees beneath her, and eyed that pattern, just there, a body's length away and still streaming down. If she launched herself from this place, simply threw herself forward, would that flowing net catch her? Would it simply shatter? Or flow aside, opening up to permit the downward plunge of a body frozen solid, lifeless, eyes open but seeing nothing. She had a sudden thought shivering up through her doubts, her fears, and with aching limbs she began dragging up the length of her chains, piling the links on the beam in front of her. Was the gate's cold of such power that it could snap these links? If she heaved the heap into that gate as much as she could, would the chains break? And then? She snarled.
Yes, and then what? Run like a hare, leave the wagon far behind, flee the legions of chaos? And when the gate itself is destroyed, where will I run then? Will this world even exist?
She realized then that such questions did not matter. To be free, even if only for a moment, would be enough.
Apsalara, the mistress of thieves, how good was she? Why, she slipped the chains of Dragnipur.
She continued piling up links of the chains, her breaths coming in agonized, lung-numbing gasps. Draconis stumbled away from Pearl's side. He could not bear the emotions the demon stirred to life within him. He could not understand such a power to forgive, never mind the sheer madness of finding something worthwhile in this cursed realm. And to see Pearl standing there, almost crushed beneath the twitching, dripping bodies of fallen comrades, no, that too was too much. Kataspala had failed. The pattern was flawed. It had no power to resist what was about to assail them. It had been a desperate gambit, the only kind Draconis had left, and he could not even rail at the blind, legless Tist Andy.
None of us were up to this. The moment Rake ceased killing things, we were doomed.
And yet he found he had no rage left in him when he thought of Anamanda Rake. In fact, he had begun to understand, even sympathize with that exhausted desire to end things, to end everything. The delusion was calling it a game in the first place. That very founding principle had assured ultimate failure. Bored gods and children with appalling power, these were the worst sorts of arbiters in this scheme of existence. They fought change even as they forced it upon others. They sought to hold all they claimed even as they struggled to steal all they could from rivals. They proclaimed love only to kill it in betrayal and spite. Yes, Draconis understood Rake. Any game that played with grief was a foul thing, an abomination.
Destroy it. Bring it all down, Rake. Rake, my heir, my son in spirit, my unknown and unknowable inheritor. Do as you must. I stand aside. Oh, bold words. When the truth is, I have no choice.
The force that suddenly descended upon the realm of Dragnipur was of such magnitude that, for an instant, Draconis believed the chaos had finally reached them, and he was driven to his knees, stunned, half-blinded. The immense pressure bore down, excruciating, and Draconis ducked his head, covered it with his arms, and felt his spine bowing beneath a crushing presence. If there was sound, he heard nothing. If there was light, he saw only darkness. If there was air, he could not draw it into his lungs. He felt his bones groaning. The torture eased with the settling of a skeletal, long-fingered hand on his right shoulder. Sounds rose once more, strangely muted, a renewed storm of wailing terror and dismay. In front of Draconis, the world found its familiar details, although they seemed ghostly, ephemeral. He was able, at last, to breathe deep, and he tasted death. Someone spoke above him.
"He is indeed a man of his word."
And Draconis twisted round, lifted his gaze, the hand on his shoulder rasping away with a rustle of links, and stared up at the one who had spoken, at Hood, the Lord and High King of the Dead.
"No!"
Draconis bellowed, rising only to stagger back, almost tripping on his chains.
"No! What has he done? By the abyss, what has Rake done?"
Hood half raised his arms and seemed to be staring down at the manacles enclosing his gaunt wrists. Disbelief collapsed into shock and then raw horror. This made no sense. Draconis did not understand. He could not, gods, he could not believe. He spun round then and stared at the legions of chaos. Oh, they had been pushed back, a league or more, by the arrival of this singular creature, by the power of Hood. The actinic storm clouds had tumbled in retreat, building anew and seeming to thrash in frustration. Yes, an interlude had been purchased, but...
"Wasted, all wasted. Why? This has achieved nothing. Hood, you were betrayed. Can you not see that?"
"No." Draconis clutched at his head.
"Rake, oh Rake, what did you want of this? How could you think it would achieve anything?"
"I have missed you, Draconis,"
Hood said, and he twisted round once more, glaring at the god. Jaggert, yes, the mad, unknowable Jaggert.
"You damned fool. You asked for this, didn't you? Have you lost your mind?"
"A bargain, old friend,"
Hood replied, still studying the chains on his wrists.
"A gamble."
"What will happen when chaos claims you? When chaos devours the realm of death itself? You have betrayed the gods, all of them. You have betrayed all life. When you fall..."
"Draconis,"
Hood cut in with a sigh, reaching up now to pull back the hood, revealing that withered, jagged face, the clawed lines of eternal sorrow.
"Draconis, my friend," he said softly, "surely you do not think I have come here alone?"
He stared at the god, for a moment uncomprehending, and then he caught a distant roar of sound, edging in from three of the four horizons, and those indistinct skylines were now seething, as the armies of the dead marched at the behest of their lord. From one side, a score of riders was fast approaching.
"Hood," Draconis said, numbed, baffled. "They are unchained."
"So they are."
"This is not their fight."
"Perhaps. That is, as yet, undecided."
Draconis shook his head.
"They cannot be here. They cannot fight the enemy. Those dead, Hood, all they have left is their identities, each soul barely holding on. You cannot do this to them. You cannot ask this of them."
The god was now eyeing the wagon.
"All I shall ask," he said, "of the fallen, Draconis, is that they choose of their own will. After this, I shall ask nothing of them. Ever again."
"So who will claim the dead?"
"Let the gods see to their own."
The coldness of that response staggered Draconis.
And what of those who worship no gods?
Yes, what of them?
What's that supposed to mean?
After this, Hood said, still studying the wagon, the dead will not be my concern ever again.
The approaching riders rode rotted skeletal mounts. Ragged capes flailed out behind the warriors. From the advancing armies, countless standards wavered and pitched about amidst upthrust spearheads. The numbers were indeed unimaginable. Broken fragments of war songs arrived like tatters of wind. The realm groaned. Draconis could not comprehend the weight that must now be crushing down the weapon's wielder. Could Draconis have withstood it? He did not know. But then, perhaps even at this moment, Anamanda Rake himself was dying, bones snapping, blood spurting. But there was more, here, before his eyes. All the creatures chained to the wagon had ceased pulling the enormous edifice. For the first time in millennia, the wagon had stopped rolling. And those creatures stood or knelt, staring outward, silent, perhaps disbelieving, as legions of the dead closed in. A flood, an ocean of iron and bone. The riders arrived, strangers all to Draconis. Six trotted their withered mounts closer. One of them was masked, and he had seen those masks before, a host slain in succession by Anamanda Rake, Sagule. The marks upon this one told Draconis that he was looking upon the second. Had he challenged the first, or had someone challenged him? The second was the first to speak.
This is the sorry shithole you want us to fight for, Hood, flinging ourselves into the maw of chaos.
The masked face seemed to scan the huddled, bedraggled creatures in their chains.
What are these that we must now die again for? That we must cease for? Miserable wretches, one and all. Useless fools! Dah! Hood, you ask too much.
The Lord of Death did not even face the Sagula as he replied.
Do you now change your mind, knight? No, he said. I was just complaining.
He drew out a pair of notched, rust-stained swords.
You know me better than that. Still, oh, how I wanted Skinner. To lose him this way, by the tyrant, it galls. That is why, said Hood, you will not lead the dead into this war. What? I am the Knight of Death, the damned bony fist himself. I demand... Oh, do be quiet, second, sighed the Lord of Death. Other tasks await you, and you will not rue them, I am sure. Iskar Jarak, will you command in the knight's stead, at the head of the spear, driving into the very heart of the enemy?
The one so addressed had the look of a veteran among veterans, grey-bearded, scarred, wearing threadbare faded colours over his plain chain hauberk, grey and magenta, bordered in black. At Hood's request, he faced the Jagut.
We will harden the point, he said, with malazans, at the very tip, my bridge-burners. Dujek on my left flank, Bolt on the right with the seventh and his Wiccans.
He then twisted in the saddle to regard another soldier.
Brucalion and his grey swords to the right of Bolt.
Brucalion nodded.
I find honour in that, Iskar Jarak.
Scammer Ara, your Jakaruku legions to the left of Dujek. Hood, listen well. Beyond the spear, so many of the rest are so much dross. Their will is weakened by countless millennia. They will march into the face of the enemy, but they will not last.
Yes, said Hood.
Just so you know, said Iskar Jarak. Just so you know.
Return now to your forces, Hood commanded. Iskar Jarak, send to me the one-eyed outrider, and Bolt, find my soldier, the one once named Bodin. There are things still to do.
Draconis watched as the commanders rode off, with only the Segula remaining, swords sheathed once more.
Hood, he said, what is happening here? You will ask the dead to fight for us? They will fail. They will earn oblivion and naught else. They cannot succeed, Hood. The chaos pursuing Dragnipur will not be denied. Do you understand what I'm telling you?
The knight snorted.
It is you who does not understand, Elder. Long before he was Lord of the Fallen, he was Jagut. Lords of the Last Stands, ha! Sentinels of the Sundered Keeps, devourers of the Forlorn Hope. You, Elder, who stood time and again against the Tist-Andi, the Tist-Edur, you who walked the ashes of Carcanus itself, understand me. The Dur Tist-Andi and the suicidal Edur, they are as nothing to the miserable madness of the Jagut.
During this tirade, Hood continued to stare at the wagon, at its towering, tottering heap of bodies, and then the Lord of the Dead spoke.
I often wondered what it looked like, this hold creaking on its wooden wheels. A pathetic thing, really. Crude, clumsy.
He faced Draconis, rotted skin curling back from the tusks.
Now, turn it around.